It's Tuesday, October 26th, and for every time you've sworn you're quitting Facebook, there are plenty of people to take your place. We start here.
Polarization started rising in the U.S. before I was born.
Facebook says it's worth more money now than it was before some of its most damaging revelations.
Safety is seen as a cost, not as a way for growth.
So why does Mark Zuckerberg sound so annoyed? The country the world tried to liberate is back under military rule.
You could see it coming, but it wasn't inevitable. It didn't have to be.
We'll walk you through the coup in Sudan, and the dead aren't the only victims of shootings.
Do you see a future for yourself?
I do. Hopefully, but not in this city.
What students at a Philadelphia high school can tell the rest of the country about gun violence. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. There are six companies on Earth that have been deemed to be worth $1 trillion. Just six of them. Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, or Alphabet, whatever you want to call it, Saudi Aramco, and now Tesla. And that list gives you a sense of where the real power is in world commerce, right? It's not railroads, not construction, it's tech companies and energy giants that fuel tech companies. Well, another company is on the brink of joining that $1 trillion club.
Hey, everyone, and thanks for joining today.
Yesterday, on a phone call with investors, Facebook revealed its latest quarter of earnings. And if you've been paying attention lately, you know Facebook is not the darling it once was.
We need to break up Facebook.
Your focus is on your pocketbook.
I mean, it's the whole reason Mark Zuckerberg wanted to get Instagram in the first place.
Everywhere you turn, there are lawmakers saying it's grown too powerful, academics saying it's poisoned public discourse, and activists saying it's literally dangerous to people.
Congress can change the rules that Facebook plays by and stop the many harms it is now causing.
Earlier this month, a whistleblower from Facebook came forward to say that whenever her former company had to choose between safety and profits, the choice did not seem particularly difficult.
Facebook understands that if they want to continue to grow, they have to find new users. The way they'll do that is by making sure that children establish habits before they have good self-regulation.
By hooking kids.
But on this earnings call, Facebook said despite all the noise, its prospects are just as rosy as ever. In fact, its stock rose in the aftermath of this. ABC's Elizabeth Schulze covers tech and finance. Elizabeth, what was your takeaway from these earnings?
Hey, Brad. Well, the big picture here is that all these revelations, these reports about how Facebook is harming society, that's so far, at least, they are not rattling investors. Facebook reported better than expected earnings for its third quarter. CEO Mark Zuckerberg was on the company's earnings call really touting user growth and touting the bottom line.
Billions of people use our services because we build the best tools to stay connected to the people you care about, to find communities that matter to you, and to grow your small business.
And we did see daily active users in the U.S. and in Canada actually go up in the third quarter for the first time in more than a year. So that means more people daily were using Facebook's platform than in the past. That's a good sign for this company, even as these kind of reports are coming out now by the day. But I will say it wasn't all good news.
During this period, competition has also gotten a lot more intense, especially with Apple's iMessage growing in popularity and more recently, the rise of TikTok, which is one of the most effective competitors that we have ever faced.
And, you know, Brad, this sort of gets into this bigger question about if Facebook's business model needs to change or if it needs to be regulated more, as we're seeing these reports about how Facebook is allegedly prioritizing profit over safety.
Wait, yeah, Elizabeth, I'm still hung up on when you said there are more users now than there were a quarter ago. That's after, what, like a ton of bad press. It's after, you know, we had a whistleblower from inside the company, Frances Haugen, who gave damaging leaks from her former company. I mean, are there through lines from that that still serve as warning flags for how this company's going to be reacting?
I mean, you know, ultimately, Brad, we are hearing from Frances Haugen that the company says that profits are the most important thing, and that is what's good for investors overall. Whether that's good for overall society, that's really what Frances Haugen is kind of trying to flag here.
And so I think there is a real thing of there is no will at the top. You know, Mark Zuckerberg has unilateral control over 3 billion people.
And, you know, she was testifying again in the UK yesterday. She made this point that within Facebook, safety is seen as a cost, not as a way for growth.
And I think until we bring in a counterweight, things will be operated for the shareholders' interest and not for the public interest.
We're seeing examples of this not just in the U.S., and we've seen this through the Facebook papers that have now been released and reported on by several media outlets. This is happening around the world.
A leak of thousands of pages of internal documents tonight raising more questions about Facebook and whether the social media giant has fueled hate.
One example from these Facebook papers focuses on India. A Facebook researcher, according to reports in the New York Times, created a new account in India to kind of see what type of content the algorithm would serve. And what this employee found allegedly after just 3 weeks was pretty disturbing. The account was flooded with gruesome images, with hate speech. The researcher allegedly said, "I've seen more images of dead people in the past 3 weeks than I've seen in my entire life." That the account was allegedly constantly barraged by nationalist content, by misinformation, by violence. And a lot of that content was anti-Muslim. And this really gets to this bigger problem that the Facebook whistleblower has highlighted.
Facebook has never published which languages are supported and which integrity systems are supported in those languages. Because of this, they are actively misleading the speakers of most large languages in the world by saying, we support 50 languages, but most of those countries have a fraction of the safety systems that English have.
Facebook goes into these new markets without fully understanding the culture, the political backdrop, the history, because it sees a growth opportunity there.
I looked at the consequences of choices Facebook was making, and I looked at things like the Global South. And I believe situations like Ethiopia are just part of the opening chapters of a novel that is going to be horrific to read.
I was going to say, there's lots of data to go over within the U.S., even with these documents that ABC and others obtained. But like you mentioned, overseas, not just emerging markets, like they've emerged. India, Vietnam, huge online presence, countries in Africa. Now, Facebook has said it's invested significant resources in these major languages in India and that they've reduced hate speech by up to 50%, they said. But I'm wondering, what did Mark Zuckerberg himself have to say about this, Elizabeth? You said he was on the call. How is he responding?
You know, Brad, Mark Zuckerberg came out swinging on this call.
Good faith criticism helps us get better. But my view is that what we are seeing is a coordinated effort to selectively use leaked documents to paint a false picture of our company.
And Mark Zuckerberg said that the company has tried to stem hate speech. It is fighting misinformation. It's devoting resources toward that.
No matter what Facebook does, we're never going to solve them on our own. For example, polarization started rising in the U.S. before I was born.
A set of documents showing that restrictions deployed by Facebook to limit potential harmful content and mitigate violence were rolled back after the 2020 election. And on January 6th, the day of the insurrection, an internal report showed that posts calling for violence and incitement surged alarmingly.
One analyst I spoke with says that there is plenty of kind of bipartisan support to rein in some of these big companies, whether it's Facebook or Apple or Amazon. But the lack of consensus on how to really do that for now, that is a positive sign for these companies when it comes to Wall Street.
Which is why we're seeing these stock prices and these market caps rise and rise and rise. All right, Elizabeth Schulze, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, well, that was quick. A week after the U.S. tries to broker a deal in Sudan, one of the guys they were dealing with is under arrest. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
If you you had to name a quintessential philanthropy campaign intended to help impoverished countries on the other side of the world, Sudan is the obvious choice.
Stop genocide now in Darfur!
For years, Sudan's brutal dictator was the focus of the aid world. Darfur was the word of the moment. A civil war caused hundreds of thousands of deaths. South Sudan, remember, was actually able to split off and become its own country, but in Sudan itself, the dictator remained until finally, 2 years ago, when he was ousted.
Sudanese people coming out in droves demanding President Omar al-Bashir step down after a very repressive 30-year rule.
Everyone goes, wow, democracy is on its way at last. Until yesterday morning, when we started getting confirmation that Sudan's leader had been overthrown in a military coup. ABC's Connor Finnegan covers the State Department. Connor, what exactly happened here?
Brad, in the early morning hours on Monday, that leader, that civilian leader, Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, was arrested. He was detained in his home at first, and then he was taken away by military officials. The man he had been sharing power with, General Abdel Fattah Burhan, went on national television and said that he was dissolving the transitional council. This is this sovereign council that had been ruling Sudan in the last 2 years since the overthrow of that dictator, Omar al-Bashir. Burhan and other military leaders said that they would install a new technocratic government until Sudan could hold democratic elections next July. But the Sudanese people are not buying it. Thousands came out into the streets to demonstrate against the military coup, just as they had last Thursday, actually. They had poured into the streets in Khartoum and across the country to once again demonstrate their support for this transitional government, for civilian rule, and for democratic elections next year.
Injuries and gunfire have been reported. Footage from local broadcasters shows protesters carrying the national flag near the military headquarters with plumes of black smoke and fire.
But this had also been building for weeks. It was just over a month ago that over 40 military officials who were aligned with the former dictator, Omar al-Bashir, had been arrested in Khartoum on a coup attempt.
We wanted to be seen as a country that is upholding human rights, good governance.
The U.S. deployed its special envoy to Khartoum this past weekend, and he met with both Prime Minister Hamdok and General Burhan. He seemed to have had an agreement of sorts on a way forward, and within hours of his departure, Hamdok was arrested.
And then reportedly brought him and his wife to an unknown destination or unknown location after he reportedly refused to dissolve the government.
And so I think in many ways this coup was evident. You could see it coming, but it wasn't inevitable. It didn't have to be.
What went wrong here, Connor? Like, what was the reason for a military coup in the first place, or the stated reason?
Well, Brett, in the 2 years since Bashir was deposed, the transition here has been slow and it has been painful.
Everything expensive, no money, no internet, no nothing.
Sudan has struggled with hyperinflation, with food and fuel shortages. And people, I think, were really growing restless. They were growing tired of this slow transition here.
For 30 years, we were isolated. We were treated as a parasite.
I mean, that's in part because of the situation that Sudan was in under Bashir's rule. Years of corruption, neglect, and U.S. and international sanctions that had really stymied Sudan's economy. So the military said yesterday that this was all about restoring calm, about leading Sudan to a better place. But we already saw repercussions for their actions.
Any change to the transitional government by force risks assistance in our bilateral relationship more broadly.
The State Department announced on Monday that $700 million in U.S. assistance to Sudan would be paused. That's not humanitarian assistance, but it was money that the U.S. was providing the Sudanese government to aid this transition. So this kind of economic penalty is really meant to give pause to Sudan's military leadership, to make them really reconsider whether or not this is a path that they want to go down and perhaps bring renewed U.S. sanctions on them.
Right. The military says democracy is still on the way, but in a matter of months, that is rare in cases like these. Connor Finnegan, covering the State Department. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Brad.
The accidental shooting on an Alec Baldwin film set that killed one person in New Mexico is still captivating the world. But let's be real, last Thursday, that same day, two people were shot and killed at a grain facility in Nebraska. You might not have heard about it. The next night, a Friday night, according to the Gun Violence Archive, 19 people were shot and killed across the country. All of these in ones and twos, stories you would just not hear about on the national news. But those are the shootings that are affecting families day to day. Those are the shootings law enforcement spend most of their time working on. And those are the shootings that are defining entire communities in far-reaching ways. Well, starting this week, ABC News has an entire series of digital coverage devoted to gun violence in America. We'll be tracking the shootings, the numbers, and also the causes.
What goes through your head when you hear those shots and when you hear the news?
We should not be shooting our own people like this.
Recently, ABC's Zachary Quiche went to Philadelphia to see how plagues of gun violence are affecting schools. I'm not talking about school shootings. I'm not talking about guns going off in school. I'm talking about violence outside the walls, changing what life looks like inside. Zachary, thanks for being with us. Where was the school that you went to?
Simon Gratz Charter School, Brad, in North Philly. North Philly is like a lot of other cities across this country, and not only the cities, but pockets within those cities.
A chaotic scene on a street in North Philadelphia last night.
A person who shot a man 12 times in North Philadelphia.
The bus came and people start recording the people on the ground and all we hear is gunshots.
North Philly is distinctly different than other parts of the city. And in one reason is because of the kind of societal flaws that exist there, right? There's lack of investment. There's traditionally poor schools and there's high crime rate.
I'm talking about a community that's a 10-minute drive. And it's a drastically different experience for students. What do they not have in common is the color of their skin.
The issues that they're dealing with are issues that have, in many ways, long existed, but they're reaching the students and impacting the students in really problematic ways.
But young people come back into this building every day, and they're able to sit down and able to tackle their coursework when they literally had to fight for their lives in order to be able to walk into this building.
The principal there says, and we know this through research, if youngsters don't have the most basic necessities, right, if they don't have safety, shelter, food, it is so difficult to reach them in the classroom. And that's what they're dealing with there on top of the fact that they've had 9 kids in the last year that have been shot and killed by gun violence outside of that school.
Wow.
One of my students sent me a text message after we lost our 4th student this year. And she asked me, Principal Dunn, why do we live just to die? That should not be on the mind of a 12th grade student.
Each and every one of those kids have been impacted by the things that are going on both in and around that school.
Our students are navigating so much trauma that we have a team of social workers standing by at all points throughout the day.
Right. And you spoke to teachers, you spoke to the principal there, Leandro Dunn, but you also spoke to some of the students, right, Zachary? Like, you hung out with these kids. What's it like to be them right now?
Yeah, you know, my producer, Abby Cruz, and I had an opportunity to talk about it before we went there. She's actually from North Philly and fairly familiar with some of the issues that exist there. And we thought that it was important to get the kids' perspective, the youngsters' perspectives. You know, so oftentimes we hear from officials on these issues. But, right. Brad, the reality of the situation is if the officials or leaders had legitimate plans in place, perhaps we'd be telling a different story.
Do you see a future for yourself?
I do, hopefully, but not in this city, not in Philly.
And these were seniors. These were two of the young women that we talked to were actually transfer students into the school.
The other day at the Lincoln game, I used to go to Lincoln. I just transferred here last year. So I was at the game and there was a gun shooting happening. And
they've been able to take that horrible situation and use it to push them, right?
You must have some grades if you're trying to go to UVA, man.
Yeah, I would say I got good grades and in the courses that I need to have them in, physics and AP calculus and stuff like that. So
and all four of those students are on track to go to college. Some of them have received scholarships, and it's just a remarkable testament to their strength and perseverance.
And we all have to, at one point, get on a point where this should not be. This should not be normal for us.
Have you lost some people that are pretty close to you?
Yeah. I lost my uncle
in 2020. 6 months later, I lost my cousin. Last night, a woman was shot going home, like two blocks down from me. And almost every night, gunshots.
The principal tells me that there's kids who are not coming to school.
And so students walk out of their homes and they're looking over their shoulders. They're walking in groups. They're looking for people to pick them up and take them to school.
There's also kids who at the end of the school day, when activities are done, there's always a group in the hallway, he says, every day. And when he approaches them and asks them, what's the holdup? What are you waiting for? It's the trepidation to step outside. It's the fear, the unknown of what's outside that school door that has these kids both staying away and in some cases staying in.
It's a real, like, it's a war zone, like with the drugs, with the guns, with the violence. It's a real war zone.
Well, that's my last question to you, Zachary, is what do you do about it, right? Because I feel like so often the gut reaction is to say, just say no, right? Don't join gangs, join an after-school club, and you won't be around gun violence. But is there an actual plan to help these young people in a moment where it does seem like it's everywhere?
It's an issue that is complex and really difficult to get to the bottom of it. And there's obviously a number of people who are on the ground and in the trenches who have been working on these issues for literally generations, for decades. But regardless of who you talk to, I think the general sense is that it will take the same intentionality to get out of this situation that was put in to create it.
Every single person who lives in this city has to be willing to step up. Has to be willing to step up, specifically those who control dollars and who make decisions and influence policy.
There are a number of different things, but I certainly think that if you look at issues like, you know, redlining, right, the intentional idea of segregating folks and cutting them off from capital and credit and the things that you need to build neighborhoods, I think that if you look across the country and you see where some of these trends are across these cities, you'll see some common threads there. And so it will take more than money. It will take the involvement and collaboration and really the intention and the real desire to make things better by everybody, from teachers and parents to the commissioner of police and city leaders.
All right, Zachary Keesh, great reporting, great conversation with these young people. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Okay, we're going to take another quick break, but when we return, don't you hate refilling your gas tank before you return it to the rental lot? Well, those days might be numbered. One last thing is next. And one last thing. I mentioned those trillion-dollar companies. Well, one of them has only had that title for a day.
Tesla is now the sixth company in the United States to be worth $1 trillion.
Tesla cruised into 13-figure status yesterday as it struck a deal with the rental car company Hertz to sell 100,000 of its electric cars,
bulking up the net worth of Tesla CEO Elon Musk by about $23.7 billion.
Which says a lot about Tesla, but also says a lot about Hertz. After all, rental companies respond to what they think travelers will want. Well, by this time next year, one out of five Hertz vehicles will be electric cars.
There appears to just be quite a profound awakening of the desirability for electric vehicles.
That raises the question, why would Hertz take the risk and pay so much money for these cars? They're reportedly paying the full $40,000 sticker price, and they'll have to invest in charging infrastructure at every Hertz rental center.
The company filing Chapter 11 last year, but rebounding with travel and a red-hot rental car market.
Analysts say there are huge upsides here. For one, it could make Tesla lovers loyal Hertz customers. You might say, well, how many of those are there? Well, that's the real play. It costs a lot less to rent a Tesla than to buy one. So suddenly, millions of Hertz customers are likely to try driving their first electric vehicle. The more you normalize it, the more people expect it.
Hey, here we go, 0-60. Holy cow!
And that is when the money starts really rolling in. And remember, Hertz is completely restructuring because they were devastated by the pandemic, which makes me always wonder, When you lose money, how many cars are you able to buy? Start here tomorrow, hit that follow button, and we'll be on your phone or your smart speaker or your car commute every morning. I'm Brad Mielke. See you tomorrow.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.